For members only. Golf Smarter number 340, published on June 29, 2012, is brought to you by Our Golfers Mart, featuring the Golf Smarter Switchblade Divot Repair Tool with removable ball marker, available at golfsmarter.com.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
More swing change analysis with Jim Waldron.
This is Golf Smarter, sharing tips and insights from golfers and golf professionals to help lower your score. It's worked for your host, Fred Green.
Welcome back to Golf Smarter for members only, Jim.
Thanks, Fred. Great to be here again.
Well, you haven't left.
That's true, I haven't.
Nope, this is continuation.
In cyberspace, I'm back, but in real time and space, I'm still here.
We're still together after all these years. So we were getting into Tiger's changes, and you were saying less armsy, better spine angle. Part three was, and I stopped you right in mid-thought here.
Yeah,
let's just pick it right up.
I'll tell you, it's tempo. I mean, with someone asked me on one of these web forums I'm on a lot, like golfworks.com or some other ones, you know, if I had the chance to work with Tiger, this was a few years ago, what would I change? If I only had to pick one thing. And because, you know, there was a lot going on that he needed to work on. And that's, again, I respect that. He knew he didn't have that. He knew there were people, other people on tour, you know, there were better ball strikers than him. And that's the other thing people think, because he's won all this time, people think, oh, he's got the best swing out there. No, he's got one of the best swings. But he did not have, from a purely objective point of view and from his own point of view, he knew he could not trust himself with the driver, which, by the way, Haney does talk about in The Big Miss, his book.
Yes.
Accurately, which is that he missed a lot of, even though he still won majors by, you know, 15 shots, like at the Open, and 12 shots at the Masters in 97, he won those majors because of a lot of other things, not because of his ball striking, particularly with the driver.
But it's his creativity.
You know, a lot of other tournaments as well.
Yeah, his creativity on his approach shots, and it just seems like he and I'm in the process of the Haney book, that his ability to correct his mistakes on his approach shots.
Yeah, he was the greatest rookie, probably as good as, maybe as controversial to say this, but probably as good as Seve out of the trees. You know, recovering from bad lies in the rough, in the trees, in fairway bunkers. Hitting these impossible recovery shots, he was, you know, probably tied with Seve, maybe better than Seve. It's hard to tell, but you know, he's the kind of guy, he could make birdie from inside the trees, like kind of like how Mickelson can do occasionally. And he was the greatest putter by far out there when he was in his heyday, you know, 12 years ago. He had absolutely the best short game in the history of golf in his heyday 12 years ago.
Yeah, Haney talked about that he was not great at lag putting.
He didn't have to lag putt that often, though, because
right.
He was good enough with his irons. Especially his iron swing was much better than his driver swing, clearly.
Right.
He didn't hit it more than, you know, 30 feet from the hole very often. So
when he did, he got himself
in trouble. back to your original question. So with his tempo was too fast. I mean, this is something Butch knew and tried to get him to change when he was in high school and college at Stanford, and Tiger refused to do it because Tiger has, as Haney also talks about in the book, he has a long drive ego complex. He wants to be either the longest or the top five guys on tour in driving distance. And he was willing to lose tournaments because he wanted to be up there with the other guys in terms of hitting the long ball. He even said to Haney, he said, chicks take the long ball.
So, and that was very important to Tiger.
Yeah. So,
as we all know,
you know, when he was a junior golfer, he was playing and winning against other junior golfers who were 4, 5, 6 years older than him. So he was like an 8, 9, 10-year-old playing against teenagers, high school kids. And he learned that the only way he could keep up with their driver was to just simply unwind, particularly with his lower body. So if you look at the old Tiger swing from 12 years ago, the rate of rotation of his hips was blindingly fast. So fast that his shoulders would move backwards and his arms would move backwards. So it's sort of like when you accelerate your car. If you plunge on the gas pedal, right, the car starts to immediately accelerate. So the car is moving forward, but what do? You move backwards into the seat, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's called inertia in physics, or in golf instruction lingo, we call that lag pressure. So now you've got your hips firing way too early on transition to the downswing, which makes your shoulders turn more the opposite way, and it makes your arms go more towards your right or more around your body, right? It puts pressure on your forearms and your wrists, which makes it harder to release the club coming down because you've got this countervailing force pushing back on your hands, on your wrists, on your arms, right? And so what he had to do was he had to literally sling his arms across his chest to try to get the club more in front of him. And because he was such a good athlete, he could do that and still hit great shots, right? But he just couldn't hit great shots more than about 90% of the time. There was like 10% of the time he couldn't time that arm slinging motion. And if he did it too slowly, he'd hit a push slice. If he did it too fast, he'd hit a pull hook or even a snap hook. So that's all been fixed now. And part of the reason it's fixed is because if you look at his tempo now, I'm guessing it looks to my eye to be about 15 to 20% slower than 12 years ago. Hmm. But he's hitting it further. And now some of that's the equipment, but I mean, he's hitting it more in the center, more in the sweet spot, right on the button. He's hitting it purer. And he doesn't have that violent transition, violent wrenching of the hips to start his transition to the downswing. So it looks a lot smoother, and he's finishing in better balance as a result. Anytime you can finish in balance and hold your position like a statue, that's a sign that you were more likely to be in balance during the strike, during impact, right, which is where it really matters. Which is one of Hogan's big things.
Yeah, me too, right?
Hogan talked about feeling like you're rooted into the ground, your feet are pressing to the ground. He talked constantly to people he mentored, like John Schley, for example, or Chris Cheddar. He talked about you need to feel like you're just rotating your body, not shifting your weight laterally during release, during impact, and your feet are pressing in the ground. He talked about being in rock-solid balance during the strike. That was his phrase he used a lot. Because, again, it improves your odds of hitting the sweet spot, making solid contact. And if you look at Tiger and his old Tiger, another flaw they fix is he would come way up on his right heel. So his right heel would come way up in the air. So he's literally sort of standing up on the toe of his right foot when he was striking the ball.
I've noticed that. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the other thing they fix. That's a lot better. He's keeping his right heel, his connection of its sole of his right foot to the ground, much, much better than he used to. In fact, Mo Norman, who the famous Canadian tour pro and great ball striker, right before he died, in some interview up there in Canada, he said that he thought that the number one thing that was wrong in Tiger's swing, this was like 8 or 9, 10 years ago, was just what I described, losing contact with the ground, losing ground pressure in his right foot. Another Hogan secret, by the way, was to have that contact with, particularly in the right foot and right heel through the strike, stay somewhat connected to the ground.
Yeah, let me ask you about that, because so many people, especially those who just pick up a set of golf clubs and just go out and start swinging, I frequently notice that they will, on their backswing, not only will their left knee just point, way behind them on the backswing, mm-hmm. but also they'll bring up the left heel, the left foot.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Your theory on that is where does the knee go, where does the heel go on your left leg you're a right-handed golfer?
Again, if I was a sling style or a throw style teacher, I would say, oh, obviously you got to lift your left heel up in here. Look at Nicklaus. Look at young Johnny Miller. Look at Tony Lima from the 60s and 70s. They all had their heel way up in the air. Or look at Bubba today. Bubba Watson's heel has got to be 5 inches off the ground at the top of the backswing. But again, why would you teach that to someone unless they really lack? If I had a senior golfer, maybe age 60 or older, who really lacked flexibility, then obviously that person's going to have to allow their left heel to come off the ground at least somewhat, or they won't be able to finish they won't be able to turn their shoulders enough to play good golf, right? Because the more you let your heel come up, the more you can turn your hips, and the more you can turn your hips, the more you can turn your shoulders. So if you lack flexibility as a senior, or for any reason, you got to let that left heel come up a little bit. But the modern swing, which is based on science, on biomechanics, which is the main rule in sports biomechanics, is don't move a body part at all. In other words, don't contract a muscle to move a bone or a joint unless it contributes to an overall effective motion. So the whole idea is to use as few moving body parts as possible, which we see in the leveraged spin swing or even in the ultra spin swing. And we don't see that in the slinging style. We see a lot of extraneous body motion. So my theory is if you have to lift it the minimum necessary amount to complete close to a 90-degree shoulder turn and no more than about a 60-degree hip turn. And that's because it's being pulled up in the air by your hips and your shoulders. So when you torque to the right, when you coil to the right, you turn your belly, you turn your chest, you turn your hips. Basically, the belly and the chest turn is turning the hips, and the hips are lifting the left heel. One's pulling the other, right? Mm-hmm. But it's potential source of loss of contact with the ground. If you have poor ground pressure, you tend to have poor balance. Mm-hmm. That's the downside to it.
Okay. So
most people who do it don't need to do it. They're just doing it because it's just natural to do it that way, and you know they think they're supposed to do it. It's a law of the golf swing. It's not.
Have you noticed that so many of those people don't even know they do it?
Sure.
Wow.
Don't even get me started on that, Fred.
Hey, this is a members-only show. Get started.
99% of my, not just my students, every teaching pro I know, are unaware of 99% of their flaws.
Oh.
Yeah. People do all kinds of stuff, have no clue. That's one of the things we've talked about in prior podcasts with you, is how, you know, one of the big things you have to be good at this game is body awareness. You've got to be able to start feeling your mistakes in real time, in the moment or the micro moment that they're happening.
Wait. Not aware that what they're doing is a mistake, or not aware that the mistake they're doing, that they even do it?
No, the second part, that they're even doing it.
They don't even know that they even do that.
And again, the reason most golfers, in fact, I would venture to guess that probably 95% of your listeners, unless they're already very good players, let's say the 95% of your listeners...
Well, the long-time listeners are much better players than they were when they started.
Yeah, exactly, of course. But I'm saying the people who are probably, I could throw a ballpark figure out there. Probably if you're about a 15 handicap or higher, there's about a 95% chance that most of the time on the range and on the golf course, you're not aware of anything happening in your body, and you're stuck in your head thinking swing thoughts or telling body parts what they should or should not be doing, or picturing body parts, and your body part that you're picturing or talking to is doing exactly the opposite of what you're telling it to do.
Wow.
That's, you ask any teaching pro who does what I do for a living, teaches people the golf swing all day, you know, that's a full-time job. After the first month on the job, that's what you realize. What people intend to do, again, 15 handicaps and higher, almost never manifests in their golf swing. Because it doesn't matter what your conscious mind is doing. It's what your subconscious mind believes to be true that creates your body motion, good or bad. Which is something else I have on my list here, my little outline, my little cheat sheet for talking with you today in this podcast, which is, you know, you need to understand, you people out there, you average golfers, you guys need to understand this principle. If you believe in your subconscious mind that the only way to get the ball airborne is to make the club head make a low to high motion as it contacts the ball, i.e. scooping, right?
Yeah.
Even if you know intellectually that that's dead wrong information, that you're supposed to make a downward blow in most clubs, right, for the ball, for the loft of the club to be effective, make the ball get airborne. Even if you know that intellectually what the true information is, if your subconscious believes the opposite, that's what your body will do.
Yeah.
Because the subconscious controls the body, right? Not the conscious.
Right. I mean, even after doing this podcast for so many years and learning so much, it wasn't until I put the Tour Tempo training club in my hand that I realized that I was not coming down on the ball at all.
So you were too slow you didn't get the timing of the beep right, you mean?
Well, I mean,
you were lagging behind?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, my hands were, you know, like I was trying to... Dr. Joe Parent, I was trying to have the bottom of my swing of that circle at when it made contact with the ball, as opposed to making the bottom of the swing being a couple inches in front of the ball.
Correct. Yeah.
I mean, this stuff is me like, oh, I mean, I have these revelations on this stuff, these epiphanies in these conversations.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Fred.
No, I'm just saying, and it wasn't until I actually had that Tour Tempo training aid in my hand that I was like, oh, that's what that means to hit down on the ball.
Right. And, you know, and that's one of the most fascinating and kind of cool things about
golf. The Tour Striker, not Tour Tempo. Tour Striker.
You mean the Tour Striker, right?
Yeah. Tour Tempo is something else I wanted to ask you about, but we'll get there in a minute.
Yeah. But this issue, again, I mean, I watch the Golf Channel a lot, right? I mean, I do this, like, you know, when I'm not working on my days off, I do like a 3-hour yoga Pilates thing in the morning, right? Because I get this chronic low back thing. If I don't do that, I literally can't play or can't teach.
Yep.
So I have all this time to watch the Golf Channel. I DVR episodes. And there's a lot. It's gotten better over the years in some ways. There's more fundamental or more laws of body and club motion based instruction than there used to be. It used to all be swing corrective on the Golf Channel.
Mm-hmm.
I like a lot of stuff Randall Chamblee has to say, as far as what some of their punts, even though he's on the polar opposite issue of versus Tiger swing changes than I am, I still respect his opinion. I think he's a real bright guy. But you never hear this talked about. And it might be because they don't have, except for maybe Martin Hall and Michael Breed, who are both very good teachers. They have, you know, they're on there. They have regular shows. But even those two guys, they don't talk much about the philosophy. I would even go so far as to say the epistemology, which is that branch of philosophy dealing with how we know what we know, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like the early version of neuropsychology, right? How do we know how to go about making a swing change? Well, one of the things you run up against as a serious student who is working with a teacher is that you're making bad body motions that you cannot stop in the short term from making. And it can be very, very, very frustrating for the student. And so they need to know ahead of time going in, you know. By the way, not everything you work on is like this. Some things you can change relatively quickly and easily, right? Some aspects of the swing, and it's different for every individual, will be relatively easy to make the change, much faster than you might think, right? Other things will sort of take a moderate amount of time, so they're just a little bit frustrating. But there'll be some things you're going to work on, especially if you're doing a fundamental-based approach, not a swing corrective approach. If you're working with a teacher on, like Tiger did with Sean, on stopping his arm sling across his chest move, which, by the way, 99.9% of average golfers do. That's a real common thing to do wrong, right?
Explain that again. Give me more detail on that, what you mean.
Well, you know, we always talk about midline. So your spine is midline of your body. If you're facing the mirror, you look at your torso, right? So midline is longitudinally, you cut your body in half. In other words, draw your finger from your Adam's apple down to your belly button. That's your midline, right?
Mm-hmm.
What the best ball strikers do, even the ones who use the Colin Montgomery, you know, the Bubba, the sling style, right? Even though they are swinging their arms across their chest, they do most of that swinging across their chest after impact, after the ball's gone. Wow. In other words, if you look at a tour pro, his left arm, measuring it where his left hand is well, I'm talking about, you know, 6, 8, 9, 10, 12 inches to the right of midline at the moment he strikes the ball. And Joe Average, who's like, you know, 20 handicap or higher, his left arm is completely the opposite. It's 10, 12 inches to the left of midline at impact. Because that person is taking the muscles in their upper arm where they connect to the shoulder girdle, and they're using those muscles to sling or fling or throw the arms across midline, across the chest. And I call that the number one flaw in golf. It's very pervasive. It's almost universal.
Wait a minute. You got me confused here. The
okay.
left hand
yeah.
for a right-handed golfer, the left
Correct.
Hand for the 20 handicapper, the left hand
right.
is right or left of the ball?
Left.
Left.
Not
of
left
the,
of the ball, left of their body's midline. In other words, what the
Isn't
average
that in
player
front of
does
the ball,
is
though?
They slow down their – I'm sorry, Fred, go ahead.
Isn't that the front of in front of the ball, ahead of the ball? If it's left of the
well,
midline?
It's better not to use the – if we use the ball as a reference, we'll lose everybody. So it's not about the ball. It's about where your hand is relative to your body, to in this case, to midline, right?
Okay.
In other words, the tour pros, no matter which of those four swing styles they use, to some extent, their body is moving to an open position as they strike the ball, right? Like on a sling style or on a thrust style, the shoulder girdles are going to be – just a little bit open at impact, maybe a 5 or 10 degrees. With an ultra spin style, like if you look at a Hogan on a driver, or today Jim Furyk, who uses a kind of an ultra spin forward swing and a slinging style backswing. He's got a very unusual swing, obviously. But those guys, you know, the guys who use the ultra spin especially, their shoulder girdle on the driver is like 35 degrees, sometimes even 45 degrees open to the target line at the moment of impact.
Wow.
But they don't hit the ball 45 degrees to the left. They don't hit a big pull. They hit it dead straight, basically, right? Because their arms are to the right of their spine at impact. But the average person, when they approach impact, they slow down their body speed. It's called pivot stall. And they, as their body slows down, they sling their arms across, kind of like trying to line up their left arm with their left armpit. That's kind of what they're trying to do.
Okay.
Almost going back to their starting, to their address or setup position. Whereas in reality, address and impact are very, very, very different in a good golf swing. In other words, your arms are further to the right of your body at impact than they were when you started on a good golf swing.
Right.
And the average person thinks just the opposite. They think they're supposed to be further to the left than when you started.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, because they believe that, at least subconsciously they believe it, that's what they do.
Very interesting.
And good players don't do that. To varying degrees, again, depending which of those four styles they're using, their arms are to the right, their arms are, both arms are to the right of midline at impact.
Can I talk about tempo with you a little bit more?
Yeah, sure.
Are you familiar with John Novosel's work?
Uh-huh, yep.
And his tour tempo and the 3-to-1 and the on the swing, and then on the short game, the 1-to-1, which we spoke about recently.
Yeah, I was aware of it. I think we even talked on the phone when it first came out, or when I first heard about it, and we discussed it, and it's 100% accurate. The only thing I think that's wrong with it is he based it on when the club head starts to move back, starts to move in the forward swing down and forward.
Uh-huh.
And even though that's one way you could define it, and that turns out to be a 3-to-1 ratio, that's not when the forward swing begins from a subjective golfer standpoint. The forward swing begins way earlier than that. Meaning, if you look at a good player, their tailbone is actually shifting to the left while the club is still moving back, finishing the backswing.
Oh, interesting.
So if you define it, which is how I define it, then it's actually a 2-to-1 ratio, not a 3-to-1.
But I guess on a visual, I mean, because it seemed like he was basing it all on frames per second on video.
Yeah,
know, it's like easy to mark that club movement, right?
But see, because he's not a golf teacher, this is he's more of I call a golf researcher than it's someone who teaches, like I do.
Okay.
Every day in the trenches, so to speak. Mm-hmm. You learn real quickly that if you get a student to focus too much on the club, I try to get my students not to focus on the club at all. And so if you define the swing, the forward swing, is when the club head starts to move forward, then he's right. It's a 3-to-1 tempo. But one of the worst things you can do, especially if you're an average golfer, is to wait too long at the top to sense a pause. Because, again, what great players do is their lower body is already starting the forward swing while their shoulders are still completing the backswing. So if you look at the average tour pro, they have around 10 to 15 degrees of shoulder turn to complete when you see their tailbone starting to shift over to the left to start the forward swing with their lower body. They don't wait till they sense the club head stop moving for a fraction of a second and then start their tailbone shift to the left. Does this make any sense?
Mm-hmm.
They're moving their lower body first,
mm-hmm.
well before they finish their backswing.
I wish I had.
So that's how. Yeah.
I was saying, I wish I had 9 or 10 hours a day to practice my golf swing.
Think of it this way. If you look at a baseball pitcher or a quarterback in the NFL, when they're extending their arm back and rotating their chest and shoulders back, that last little bit of chest rotation in the back move, right? While they're doing that, their lower body is stepping into the throw. It's called natural athletic throwing motion in biomechanics. So their lower body is moving toward the target while their upper body is moving away from the target at the same time. Nobody stops the whole body motion all at once and then starts the body motion all at once. The lower body's moving toward the target while the upper body moves away from the target. And that's an important, what we call law of the transition.
Yeah, I've always struggled with this concept of pausing at the top of the swing and people who, kind of hang there for a moment.
Uh-huh.
And you see them thinking about it.
It's a big flaw.
Yeah.
The main reason why it doesn't work is when people pause, where literally their lower body's not shifting, it's stopping when their shoulders stop, and when the club stops, everything kind of stops altogether. It allows an opportunity for the conscious mind, the non-athletic intellectual thinking mind, to jump back on stage, push the subconscious mind off stage, and take control of the golf swing in three main areas. The hit impulse takes over, the scooping impulse takes over, and the steering or manipulation impulse takes over. In fact, it could be all three.
Hmm.
And so what do people do who are 15 handicaps or higher? What's one of the big flaws they do? They throw the club head from their wrist joint at the ball when they start their forward swing. They don't maintain the wrist angle on the way down like the pros do. Why don't they? Because they see the ball, they sense their body stopping the motion all at the same time, and it's a pause that allows them to think, hit the ball. And so a voice in their head literally says, I'm not making this up, hit the damn ball! Exclamation point. And so they do with the wrong body part, their wrists or their arms or their right elbow or all three. Whereas what the pros do is while they're finishing the backswing, they aren't thinking about hitting the ball because all they're thinking about is sort of reconnecting to the ground, shifting their weight left with their lower body, and kind of like Nicklaus called it, settling into the shot. And, you know, we in our school, we developed a drill for this called Get Ready, Get Set, Go. And you can do it with a ball or without a ball. But basically, you say the phrase get ready as you do your backswing. When you do the transition, the way I described it, where you're finishing your shoulder turn, that last 10 degrees or so, and your tailbone shifting left, you say get set, meaning get set, right? Not get ready, go, which is what high handicappers do when they succumb to the hit impulse. It's get ready, get set. And then when your hands get down below waist high or around waist high with your wrists fully cocked, then you say go, and you create the go by simply turning your body and letting centrifugal force snap open your wrist cock angle. So it's get ready, get set, go, not get ready, go. So when you pause, it becomes get ready, go. Mm-hmm. And but back to John Novosel. So I think if he would have presented it as a 2-to-1 rhythm, and that's what I call rhythm, not tempo. Tempo to me is the elapsed time on the clock from start to finish of your swing, which is roughly 1.5 seconds duration. So if you saw it as a 2-to-1 ratio, it would be when you feel you're in the 3/4 backswing position, not full backswing, you begin what we call the transition trigger, which is your brain has to send an impulse to your belly, to your oblique abs, to shift to the left, followed by a shifting of your tailbone to the left. And so that's the trigger. That's what creates your transition. Your initial transition trigger is that shifting of your belly muscles to the left while your shoulder girdle is coiling to the right. And then when you define it that way, if that's the beginning of the forward swing, when you fire the belly to the left, it's exactly or nearly exactly a 2-to-1 ratio, not a 3-to-1. It just works better that way. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you're waiting to feel that everything, that the club is pausing for that fraction of a second, your shoulders are pausing for that fraction of a second, and you got to time the beep, that beep with your impact beep.
Very good. I want to get back to Tiger again, because this is so much fun.
Yeah.
If here we are a week and a half in front of the Open being played at the Olympic Club in San Francisco, which is, you know, from all indications, it's going to be a brutal course on these guys. I mean, the U.S.
Yeah,
Open,
yeah.
That's the whole point of the U.S. Open anyway, right? I mean,
sure.
You know, one under par could win the whole thing. Where,
right.
You know, other tournaments.
Or even one over par.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, following what Tiger's been doing, and he even commented after the memorial in the press conference that his book from, and I found this fascinating, his book from 98, he had to throw it out. It's almost a completely different golf course.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm curious, here we are a week and a half in front, and when people are going to be listening to this, it's going to be, well, afterwards. You want to make any predictions?
Well, I think you got to make Tiger the favorite the way he's playing. No, and I'm pretty sure on the sports betting sites he is the favorite, too. Mm-hmm. You know, you'd hope it'd be a Rory-Tiger matchup, but obviously Rory's in a little mini slump with missing 3 cuts in a row, which is kind of a shame.
And that's got to hurt a young man's confidence, too.
Yeah, yeah. That.
And know, what do you see there?
I'm sure he'll get it back at some point, but that's going to be the big Nicklaus-Palmer rivalry of the modern era. It's going to be McIlroy-Woods, at least for the next, I don't know, Tiger's, what, 36 still?
Yeah.
He'll be 37, I think, in December or January.
And do you think
he's probably got 8 more years left of really good golf, at least, I think, if he stays healthy.
Yeah, yeah. And do you think that, you know, there's two benchmarks here that we're looking at. One is winning 9 more tournaments to have more wins than anybody else, and the 10th would be. And then there's the majors. There's Nicklaus Majors and reaching that. Do you think both of those he'll be able to achieve in the direction that he's heading with this swing change?
You know, if you'd asked me that a year and a half ago, I would have said I was saying no at the time, because I really saw how badly his confidence was shattered by the scandal.
Yeah.
And also by his injuries. You know, I've struggled a lot in my own injuries the last 8 years with my back and some other health issues. And it's a hard game when you're healthy, right?
Yeah.
But at the highest level, imagine what it's like playing golf in front of millions of people. You're being paid millions of dollars by your corporate sponsors to win and to do well and to draw viewers in to watch the TV broadcast. And then this horrible personal scandal erupts and you've got, a broken tibia in 3 spots. And massive ACL damage, and a left Achilles tendon, tendonitis, and occasionally has a problem with his neck and with his lower back. I mean, the guy is just, I mean, what can you say? I mean, it's hard. It's, you know, it's hard to play golf if you have, for whatever reason, if you have no confidence or very little confidence, it's almost impossible to play well. But what appears to be the case is that, in his case, it was more the other way. He did it the Bobby Knight way. He so improved his technique. His swing is so much better than it used to be. I can't tell you, I can't praise Sean Foley and Tiger enough for what they've done. It's just really remarkable. I mean, his swing is almost as good as Justin Rose's. It's almost as good as Sean O'Hare's. It's almost as good as Hunter Mahon's in terms of just technically correct. You're hitting all the positions and the plane angle. It's a lot simpler golf swing than it used to be. And, you know, if he gets, I guess he's still a little bit not super confident on his short putts of around 6 feet to 2 feet in that range.
Amazing.
But if he gets some practice timing on that, which he probably will do now that his golf swing is so much better, he's not going to need to practice his ball striking so much. He'll be able to go back to his, you know, his former amount of time dedicated to putting and short game. No, I think he's going to break Nicklaus's record by maybe 5 or 6 majors. I think he will.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, he's only got to make 5 more to he's got 14. Nicklaus has 18. So, yeah, I think he could easily win 10 more majors. It all depends on his health. If he stays healthy,
right, and that's always,
which apparently he's dedicated to doing. I mean, he works out all the time, and you know, I mean, he could certainly win a major. I could see him if he stays healthy with his new swing, which is, by the way, the new swing is easier in his back than his old swing. Yeah, I can see him winning a major even in early to mid-50s. I mean, if he stays healthy.
Wow!
So you think he could be.
And you think he'll stay on this tour? Won't go over to the Champions Tour even when he gets to his 50s?
Yeah, I think that's kind of. I mean, he'll probably do both there for a few years, and eventually maybe in his mid-50s go to the Champions Tour. He may quit golf though. Who knows? I mean, he may just decide to he's had enough and he'll do something else. But. Yeah. I really do think he's back. And you know, if he starts winning a few more tournaments, his confidence is going to soar. And once people don't realize, and I've said this before, I think on your broadcast, but I'll say it again. The reason he was the greatest player when he dominated back in, that was in 1996 when he came on tour, he really dominated between there and about, 2002, I guess. That was a 6-year period where he really won everything pretty much. He was the best putter. Now, I'm not talking about mechanics. I'm just talking about getting the ball in the hole. All those mechanics were certainly good. He was the best short game wizard out there by a mile. But the reason he won and the reason he dominated was he was orders of magnitude more confident than anybody else on the tour. And he knew he was more confident than anybody else, and all the other players knew he was more confident.
There was an intimidation factor as well.
Yeah. Exactly.
I mean, everybody on the course knew, everybody who had clubs in their hands on the course knew that if he was making a move, they couldn't play defensively anymore. They had to be more aggressive. And
right.
It's like, oh, my gosh, what are we going to do now?
This is another one of my pet peeves in golf instruction. I mean, and some of this is, you know, something I've certainly learned more in the last few years. I've always known this, but I've really known it because of my own struggles with my low back issue and not playing well. Most of the time, the last 5 years, even after my back has been partially healed, which it has been recently, I found something that works. I'm still hitting some bad shots compared to how I used to hit it, purely because I don't have the confidence. Hmm. And you know, and if you have, in my case, it's fear of hurting my back from just unwinding, turning my hips and my body through the shot. When you have that fear that you're going to hurt yourself, you'll flinch, and then the flinch will create the bad shot. And then the next time you go to hit a golf ball, you've got two things going on. You've got fear of hurting yourself, the original issue, and you've got the fear of hitting a bad shot, which is another way of saying you lack confidence. So what I've been doing just recently in my own game, which has really helped a lot, is something I've taught people for years, but really lately, I'll expand on this here in a minute, with average golfers I've been doing it, which is to teach confidence as a fundamental of the golf swing. A fundamental of the putting stroke, a fundamental of your short game strokes. It's like an essential piece of the pie or piece of the puzzle that you must have. You could have the greatest golf swing mechanics in the world, the greatest balance, the greatest timing, but if you walk up to the golf ball and you lack confidence in your ability to hit it well, guess what? You're not going to hit it well.
No.
It's that important. In some ways, it's more important than mechanics. And so what I've done in the last couple of years in my teaching is basically made this a very, very important principle. And I tell people, look, there's no point in walking on the golf course if you're going to have fear over a golf shot or if you're going to have anxiety over a golf shot. I'm not talking about the beginning of the sure. If it's long par three over water, you get 220-yard carry, and the wind, you get a one or two-club wind in your face. And if you hit it really good with your three-wood, you might make it over. You know, it's normal in the beginning of the of your routine to have fear. The point is you can't stay with that fear when you're striking the ball. At some point, before you walk up to the ball and settle into your setup, your starting position, you've got to banish that fear and replace it with confidence. And there's a technique for that. There's a technique for method acting. There's a technique from NLP for how to do that. It's called changing your state. You can change your state, consciously choose to change your state from one of fear to one of courage. And to me, it's so important to do that. And I think, again, that's what Tiger had that nobody else had to that extent. And he's starting to get it back. And because he's getting it back, I really think he's going to start winning a lot.
Interesting. What did you know about Sean Foley before Tiger announced that he was going to be working with him? Had you heard about him?
Well, yeah, I did. I mean, yes, you know, yeah, there's sort of a inside baseball sort of gossip thing that happens in the golf community.
Cool.
I heard good and bad things. I heard that he had, and he's actually admitted this to his credit, he had taken on Parker McLaughlin from Hawaii as a student and basically ruined his game. And Sean is, I mean, I hate to be blunt, but that's, as you know, that's my style. He radically changed his left hand grip from one that, from an ideal standpoint, probably was a little too strong, too much turn to the right. And he tried to move it over too quickly to the left. And, you know, and I think what Sean has since learned, he said this, is that, you know, with a really good player, you get a real talented tour pro, it's like a thoroughbred racing horse. You don't want to do too many changes to it. You don't want to change his diet too much. You don't want to change his exercise routine, because you might ruin it, right? There's so much natural ability with an already gifted player like a tour pro. What you want to do for the most part is, unless the pro wants a radical change like Tiger did, and Tiger basically said to Foley, throw the book at me. This Haney stuff ain't working. I got to do something. I mean, I'm dying here. I got to change my swing, right? He knew that there were some fundamental weaknesses in his Haney swing. Things were not only not getting better, but they were getting worse, particularly with the driver. So in that case, Foley said, okay, I'll throw the book at you. So they embarked in a process of radical swing changes. Well, I don't know what happened with Parker and Sean in terms of what Parker expressed, but I mean, obviously Parker wanted to get better at ball striking. Sean said, we're going to change your grip, and it made him worse. And that's always the problem when you make a back to the pros and cons of the two methods. The cons of a radical swing change are, at least temporarily, even for an average player, let alone a tour pro, you can get worse. In my experience, it tends to be the opposite, though. Average players tend to get really, really good pretty quickly when you make radical changes. Again, as long as they're not too radical, sort of, you know, moderately radical. And really good players tend to get worse. So I tend to be very wary. I tend to be very conservative when I work with already gifted, low handicap amateurs and pros. And I tend to be very radical with the high handicappers who are willing to put the time in, obviously. If they tell me they're not willing to practice, then I don't do it. But if they're willing to put a year or two of training into making their swing more like a tour pros, then I'm willing to work with average players who are at that level of commitment.
So were you surprised that Tiger, from what you heard from Inside Baseball, were you surprised that Tiger chose Sean Foley?
Yeah, actually I was. But, you know, the buzz on Foley was, and if this is still true, if you listen to what Sean O'Hare was the first really good player to work with Foley. He worked with Stephen Ames, who was his first tour pro, and that was because a buddy of Stephen Ames was friends with Foley and was impressed with Foley's short game instruction. Foley was mainly he made his reputation up in Canada working with juniors, not even working with average amateur adults, although he obviously did both, but he made a niche for himself working with juniors. And they formed, I forget the name of it, ends with a C, the name escapes me at the moment, but they formed a golf academy in Orlando. And he was actually an employee of this golf academy that was mainly geared toward juniors. They had a winter base in Orlando and a summer base up in somewhere in Canada, outside Toronto. But anyhow, he met Stephen Ames through a buddy, and then Ames introduced him to Sean O'Hare. But the buzz on Foley was he was more like a mental game wizard slash mentor to some of these younger guys, actually guys who were basically around his own age or maybe a little bit younger. But Foley's very well read.
It was the core Golf Junior
core,
Academy?
Correct, core Golf Academy, right, correct.
Love the internet.
You know, I mean, he's not in the traditional mold of a golf teacher. He's left-wing in his politics, as I am. I like that. Aren't too many left-wing golf teachers out there.
Yes.
He reads philosophy. He reads psychology. And he was applying some of his, you know, some of his sort of life wisdom to these younger pros like Sean O'Hare and then Justin Rose and then Hunter Mahon. And they were basically saying he made them better, not so much because of the swing changes, because you look at Justin Rose's swing and Sean O'Hare's swing, Hunter Mahon's swing, it didn't change radically at all from their previous teachers after they worked with Foley for, like, you know, the first year or two. It's basically the same swing. It's not that big. I mean, they'll say there's changes for sure, but they're secondary, they're minor changes. But they liked working with him because he was a great mentor on the mental side. He kind of got them pumped up. He got them to believe in themselves, to have more confidence, like we were talking about earlier. And that's kind of what we heard more about. Not so much a swing change guru, but more of a mental game guru. Hmm. But now that's going to change because he and Tiger did some, like I said, some really radical swing changes, much more radical than he worked with those other guys.
Hey, listen, not that that you and I couldn't go on for another 3.5 hours, but I have an appointment in a couple of minutes. I have a business call coming up. So let's, before you go, please promote your golf schools, where, when, how to get in touch.
Sure. We have, I think, our students, most of our graduates will tell you, actually it happened so often in a few years that we changed our slogan, the best golf school in the nation.
I'll take it.
Some people say the best golf school on the planet, but I don't know if I'd go that far. But I've been everywhere on the planet, so I guess it wouldn't qualify to say on the planet. But it's very effective, and its web address is balancepointgolf.com.
And where are they held?
Portland, Oregon in the summer months, and Hawaii and Singapore in the winter months.
I would love to get a group of listeners together and come out to do a school with you. I would love to be there and work with you because you and I have talked so many times and I know your philosophy and I love your philosophy and I just would love to be able to do hands-on with you and get some listeners. I don't know how we'd ever get to do that. And frankly, I would like to do it in Hawaii. That's what I want to do.
Yeah, to come over to Hawaii. I'll be there for the first 3 weeks of December this year doing schools. I'll be there April 6th until May 11th next year. Or come over to Singapore or Indonesia. We have a branch office in Singapore, too.
So how about too. December of 2013?
Yeah, that works.
All right. So why don't we do this? Let's just throw that out there. You and I have just thrown this out there. If there are Golf Smarter listeners... Golf Smarter members specifically, that would be willing to join me to go to Hawaii and do the Balance Point Golf School in December of 2013. That's the problem I've had with these trips before. I really don't plan them in advance. But if we can get some traction going, I'm not planning a trip here, folks. I'm just trying to see if there'd be some interest. If I can get enough bodies to do this, sure, we'll move forward. But it's too hard to drag it out of you. So why don't you... email me. Click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com and let me know. If you want to do this, let's talk about it, and we'll keep our conversation going with Jim. All right?
That'd be awesome.
That would be really awesome. I mean, you and I almost...
You'd be laughing a lot.
You and I got that close to having lunch together recently, and it was my bad that it didn't happen. And I hope the graduation went well. But we still need to get together some way, somehow, and this would be a phenomenal way to do it. So
let me make one more plug, which I probably don't do enough.
I guarantee anybody
out there
listening. I opened the door for you, man. I let you do it. But
this will just take a second.
Go for it.
One of the positive feedbacks we get from almost every graduate, which is a nice side benefit besides the incredible level of improvement they get, is people also say funniest golf school. And I'm talking about my number one assistant, Cliff Goldman, who is so funny. He's sort of like a combination of Larry David and Woody Allen. And he has people literally falling off their chairs, gasping for air, laughing so hard, like on a regular basis.
Well,
so not only are you learning all this cool information about golf, you're laughing a lot, which is
awesome.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, and you know, yeah. And listen, and if you bring me along, then you'll have the corniest podcast host. who specializes in daddy humor, which means every time I tell a joke, people roll their eyes. It's like, yeah. Oh God, come on, Dad.
Yeah, I'm kind of like that too.
Yeah, right. I mean, every kid.
Yeah, I get that.
Every you know, people think you're funny, but your kids don't. What's up with that? Right.
That's my dilemma in life. Yeah. It's like
Dad.
I hear this line all the time. Not funny, Dad.
Right. Right. And you know what? I am just going to be patient because I know that so many of the jokes that I've been telling in my kids' life, when they become dads, they're going to use the same jokes, and I'm get to look at them and go, ha.
Yeah.
I hope I get to be there for that.
Well, if you like politically incorrect humor,
I'm in.
A little bit of Bill Hicks, a little bit of Richard Pryor, a little bit of Larry David, that kind of humor, you'll love me and Cliff's our stuff. We got some good bits that we use in school.
Well, best of luck with your schools coming up, Jim. It was great to speak with you again, and we will stay in touch and do it more often.
Great. Thanks, Fred.
Next up, we'll get back to the mental game with Golf Smarter Tips coach, Michael Anthony. But first, here's another call to action for you to become a Golf Smarter ambassador by picking up the new Golf Smarter Switchblade Divot Repair Tool. Make sure you get one for yourself and use your 25% members-only discount to pick up some for the rest of your playing partners. How many times have you given a gift to someone knowing that it'll get a nice reaction, then goes in a drawer? This divot repair tool, club/cigar holder, removable ball marker, is so good that I promise your playing buddies will thank you every time they play with you, and you will see that in their hand for years to come. Plus, when you place the Golf Smarter ball marker on the green, it opens the door to share stories and tips you've learned from your favorite golf podcast. Pick up your Golf Smarter Switchblade Divot Repair Tool today in the Golfer's Mart at golfsmarter.com.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.